Welcome to the second hour's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Odessa American, Monday, August 23rd. Will a Medicare Advantage plan with prescription drugs prevent the extra Part D premium? By Tony King. Hello, Tony. I am turning 65 in October, self-employed, and my income is over $250,000. Recently, I received a letter from SSA telling me that my monthly Medicare Part B premium of $170.10 would be doubled to $340.20 per month due to 2020 reported income. That was no surprise, but Social Security also said that the monthly adjustment for prescription drug coverage would be an additional $51.70. What is this all about? I am in excellent health and take no prescriptions. What happens if I do not apply for a Medicare prescription drug plan? Do I still have to pay the extra $51.70? What if a person goes the Medicare Advantage route instead of original Medicare and a Medicare supplement? Do they get to avoid the additional $340.20 per month for Part B and the $51.70 per month extra premium for a Medicare Part D prescription drug plan? Thanks, Mike from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Dear Mike, sorry, but you cannot avoid the additional IRMAA, income-related monthly adjusted amount, premiums if your income is above a certain limit, no matter if you're enrolled in Original Medicare and a Medicare supplement or a Medicare Advantage plan with prescription drug. It is going to happen anyway. If you are not enrolled in a Medicare Part D prescription drug plan, whether standalone or with a Medicare Advantage plan, you will not receive the addition Part D IRMAA premium. It is not a wise decision, however, not to enroll in a Medicare Part D plan simply because you are not taking prescriptions at the time you enroll in Medicare. Social Security bases your income on both you and your spouse, if you are married, whether they are in Medicare age or not. The MAGI, Modified Adjusted Gross Income, amount that is reported on your yearly income taxes is what triggers the IRMAA, income-related modified adjustment amount increase. The bottom line is, if your income is over these amounts and you have your Medicare prescription drug plan from either a Medicare Advantage with prescription drug plan, Part C, or standalone Medicare prescription drug plan, Part D, you will pay the additional IRMAA premium, whether you are deducting your premiums from your Social Security check or paying direct to Social Security because you have not started receiving your Social Security check. Remember, if you are not enrolled in a Medicare Part D prescription drug plan at the right time, you will not have prescription drug coverage and will receive a Part D late enrollment penalty when you sign up later. At the Tony Says office, we advise everyone to enroll in a Part D prescription drug plan, whether you are taking no prescriptions or a lot of prescriptions. No one wants an additional penalty. Enrolling in a Medicare Advantage plan instead of original Medicare with a Medicare supplement, Medigap, and a Medicare Part D plan does not keep Medicare or Social Security from charging the additional IRMAA premium for both Medicare Parts B and D. The IRMAA Medicare rule went into effect on January 1, 2011, regarding the Medicare Part D additional IRMAA premiums. Because the yearly Medicare and You handbook is generally mailed out before October 1st, the costs and premiums for Medicare for that specific year are not included. Medicare costs and premiums are typically released around November 10th of each year. Readers of the Tony Says Medicare column can visit www.tonysays.com to receive your copy of the current Medicare costs with Medicare Part B and Part D premiums for all income levels, and to sign up for the latest Tony Says newsletter, email your Medicare questions to info@tonysays.com or call 832-519-8664.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram Weekend Edition, Saturday, August 20th, 2022.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Odessa American for Monday, August 22nd. Expanding Vision, Ellen Noel to update look, make temporary move. The story was written by Ruth Campbell. With an eye toward setting itself up for success for future generations, the Ellen Noel Art Museum Board decided to add an addition, modernize its space, and make it more flexible and fix some infrastructure. In order to begin construction, the museum, located at 4909 East University Boulevard, is temporarily relocating to the Shepherd Leadership Institute at 4919 University Boulevard. Quote, "This means you can expect all future exhibits, educational programs, and Thursday night events to be held at the Shepherd Leadership Institute unless noted otherwise," a news release said. The museum will close its doors to the public on August 31st and reopen and resume normal business hours at the Shepherd Leadership Institute on September 15th, 2022, the release said. The exhibits and collection will come down at the end of August. Executive Director Sheila Perry said they will be open, but it will primarily be the garden. They will have the Movies Under the Stars August 26th in the garden, and then September 10th, they will host a large community art day. The last day the building will be open is September 11th. They will be open with a reception at the archives on September 15th. Because everything is so volatile now, Perry said they don't know how long the project will take or what the budget will be. It is being financed with donations and grants. Perry said the original budget was $12 million and there was money built in for inflation. Quote, "With the original budget, we're about 80%, so we need to raise the remaining 20% of the original budget, and then also whatever is over the original budget," Perry said. Quote, "I'm hoping it's not crazy beyond that because we did have a lot of leeway built into that budget. There are certain things that are going to phase two," she added. The contractor is Lee Lewis of Lubbock, and the architect is Parkhill in Midland. Plans are to make the museum space more flexible. The museum is just over 21,000 square feet. There will be one entry point with the renovations. They expect to add 13,800 square feet, bringing the new museum footprint to 35,600 square feet. A small second floor will be added. The gallery space will be up to 9,700 square feet. A multi-purpose gallery and theater will include 2,000 square feet and have a 100-seat capacity. The event space will enclose 4,700 square feet. There will be three spaces and classrooms. Staff offices will move out of the collection storage area to the second floor. Perry said the University of Texas Permian Basin has been awesome, as has the community as a whole. Quote, "They have been absolutely wonderful," she added. Since the Presidential Archives has sat dormant for a couple of years, they asked the museum for some guidance. Realizing they could help each other, the archives will give the museum a place to set up shop and the museum, quote, "do some work on their collections, and we're going to figure out how to animate the collection in ways that haven't happened in the past," Perry said. On their tours, Ector County ISD students will be able to view exhibits on portraiture and history and tour the Bush House. Quote, it will be more interdisciplinary this year. It will be a mix of art and history, which I think is really exciting because our community will really benefit from that, Perry said. Paula Barnett, president of the Ellen Noel Art Museum Board, said when the process of figuring out where the museum would be during construction, there were all kinds of scenarios. But Perry started talking to UTPB and a plan came together. Quote, it's so wonderful to team up with the university because we've kind of connected with them for a long time, Barnett said. She added that it's nice that they will be close to the museum building so people will know where they are. Barnett noted that the archives are already museum quality. Quote, it's going to benefit both of us because we're going to be able to help them with the presidential archives. They're helping us with the office space, Barnett said. The museum will be able to have small exhibits at the archives, she added. Quote, it's just really beyond what we thought would happen, Barnett said. She said she's been involved with the museum and the board for close to 15 years, and the museum has faced challenges with equipment and humidity levels and has had to come up with funds for repairs. When Perry came on board, Barnett said she helped the board to focus and they developed a strategic plan. Part of that was a capital campaign. Quote, we're excited about that. One of the goals is that we, from the beginning, the Ellen Noel Art Museum is not your everyday traditional museum. The design of the museum right now was kind of new at the time it was built, so we knew that we wanted to be a little different and we wanted to stand out, Barnett said. The architects shared pictures of other museums throughout the world and came up with the design. Quote, it's very different for Odessa, but on the other hand, I think it really speaks to the level of art and that we want art not just to be hanging on the wall. The building needs to reflect that it's an art museum. The architects have been wonderful, she added. Perry said the Ellen Noel will slowly move their collection to the Museum of the Southwest, including Stampede, which will be put on display in Midland. The current gallery space is cut up, so they can't display anything really large, Perry said. A couple of the exhibits we've had since I've been here, we've ended up having to put half of it in one gallery and half in the other, Perry added. New COVID-19 guidelines from CDC. The story was written by Carol A. Cates, Chief Nursing Officer, Odessa Regional Medical Center. I haven't written about COVID in quite a while. Honestly, I keep hoping I will never have to write about COVID again, but the surges in COVID cases just keep coming. Fortunately, the surges are causing less severe disease, which has resulted in fewer people needing hospitalization, and better still, fewer people dying because of this awful infection. The other thing that is going on is, now, nearly 3 years into the pandemic, we know a huge amount more about COVID. We know how it is transmitted, how long people are contagious, and how we can better control the spread of COVID. When COVID first started showing up in the U.S., it seemed like guidelines changed every day, sometimes every few hours. It was so confusing and so hard to keep up with. That was because we knew so little about COVID, and everything we did was based on trial and error to a certain extent. Let me give you an example. I think about back in the early days of medicine when doctors thought that bleeding people would cure disease. Now we know, because we have over 100 years of experience and research, that bleeding people is bad far more often than it is good. I used to wonder how bleeding ever became a regular practice, because it seems obvious to me that it's bad to bleed people on purpose. But back then, doctors didn't have access to all the data we have now. All they had was trial and error. The only results they could see were from their own practice and maybe a couple of colleagues. Heart disease was nearly as prevalent then as it is now, and in patients who have heart failure, getting rid of excess fluid is something that works and works well in getting them better. Now we have drugs called diuretics, which force the body to make more urine, which in turn gets rid of excess fluid. Those drugs are our first defense against excess fluid in people with heart failure now. Back then, those drugs didn't exist. Bleeding people probably started because someone noticed that a patient with a bad cut started breathing better and feeling better. So then, next time that person started having trouble breathing, they tried it on purpose, and it worked on that one person again. So then they tried it on others, and it kept working a good portion of the time, because bleeding does get rid of excess fluids. The problem came when they did it to excess and did it with everyone. After many, many deaths, new drugs, and a much better understanding of disease and chronic illness in general, doctors figured out bleeding doesn't work for most things, and the routine practice of bleeding stopped. We do still purposefully take blood or plasma from some people to help with heart failure and other disease conditions, but now we know when that will help rather than harm, and only do it for those patients it will help. In a much compressed time frame, because we can look at things in a larger scale because of better communication and technology, that has happened with COVID. We know much better what helps and what hurts, and are not dependent on trial and error. That is why we haven't had many updates in COVID prevention since the vaccine came out in late 2020. We have learned what works to prevent, but after over a year of vaccinations and the virus mutating where it is generally causing less severe disease, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, felt that the data supporting making some new changes. The great part about these recommendations is these changes that make COVID a bit easier to live with. The first is quarantine versus isolation. Some people think they are the same thing, but they really are not. Quarantine happens when you are exposed to a disease. Isolation happens when you have the disease. Some diseases we quarantine quickly because we want to cut off every opportunity for it to spread. And COVID, when it was at its worst, and we didn't know exactly how it was transmitted, that was certainly the goal. But we have learned with COVID, especially the newer forms, that traditional quarantining is just not necessary. The CDC now recommends that if you have been exposed, you don't have to quarantine. You just need to wear a good-fitting, high-quality mask, ideally an N95 for 10 days, and they need to test at 5 days. That lets people work, go to school, and do all the things they need to do in a day. If the test is negative, they still need to mask for the full 10 days. But if the test is positive, it gets a bit more complicated. At that point, isolation is a must. If symptoms are improving and there is no fever for 25 hours, people can stop isolating at 5 days. But if the person has moderate to severe disease, which means shortness of breath, difficulty breathing, or hospitalization, the isolation needs to continue for 10 days. That is because now we know people who are sicker generally have a bigger viral load, and the bigger the viral load, the more time it takes to clear it out of a person's system so they are not contagious. COVID, unfortunately, is probably here to stay, just like colds and flu, and these new recommendations limit its ability to spread and cause big outbreaks if we all follow them. Hopefully, the variants will continue to cause less severe disease in most people, just like it has for colds and flu, and the recommendations will continue to become fewer. My final recommendations based on all of this is, if you are sick, no matter what the cause, a cold, the flu, COVID, or anything else, stay home and away from others. Be cautious around anyone who is at high risk for severe disease if you think you have been exposed to COVID or any other illness. Finally, please consider getting vaccinated when there are vaccines available for viral illnesses, especially the flu each year, and COVID, as those vaccine frequency recommendations continue to evolve. There are lots of options out there now for COVID vaccines, including traditional vaccines, not just mRNA vaccines. Vaccination does not prevent COVID and flu completely, but they absolutely reduce the extent of the illness and they absolutely reduce the risk of death. I have seen that not just in the data, but here in the hospital and among the people I love.
This is Jane reading for the OA for Saturday, August 22nd. Kudos to the ECISD students and staff. On behalf of the Board of Trustees of the Ector County Independent School District, I bring congratulations to our team, some 4,200 strong. We want to recognize the work of our bus drivers, cafeteria workers, custodial and maintenance staff that provide so much support on a daily basis. Most important are the teachers, paraprofessionals, and campus leaders who work tirelessly to deliver quality instruction to our students each day. The dedicated focus of our teachers is clearly evident in the results we are seeing here today. Clearly, the process is in place for the positive results from our Human Resource Department team, Curriculum and Instruction team, Finance Department, and the efforts and hard work of our technology team have promoted the results we are experiencing. In addition, are the positive experiences provided to the students in our career and technology programs. Athletic and fine arts also contribute to the overall success of our district. The improvement seen over the past 3 years is not only by accident. Dr. Murray and his team embarked on a mission of improving our processes and a deliberate, unwavering expectation of quality instruction for all students. The challenges have been great over the past 3 years, and the opportunities greater. Our country, state, and school community face the challenge of an unprecedented pandemic and the challenge of providing the best instruction for all students in a remote environment. The Ector County ISD rose to the challenge. This is clearly exemplified in the results seen here today. While this is marked improvement and we will celebrate, there is still work to be done. Our district is in good hands with Dr. Murray and his team of dedicated employees. Most of all, thank you to our students for your hard work and accomplishments. Thank you to our parents for your support and dedication to your students' education. From the Board of Trustees, Ector County Independent School District. ECISD students' staff are doing great. From Dr. Scott Murray. The number of B-rated schools doubled from 6 to 12. In 2019, half the schools were rated D or F. Today, half the schools are rated A or B. 5 schools grew from an F to B. 18 schools showed double-digit gains. 3 of our 5 high schools are rated A. 5 of our 6 middle schools are rated B or C. Kindergarten readiness increased by 13 points. SAT scores increased by 40 points, and performance is above the state. STAR and EOC scores improved in almost every area. college career military readiness increased by 7 points to tie the state at 63%. Our graduation rate of 85.5% is the highest in over 20 years. We have reduced teacher vacancies from more than 350 to 58. I'm extremely proud of the 4,200 members of Team ECISD for the incredible work they have done in the middle of a pandemic and the results they have achieved. The strategic focus of our team, coupled with a commitment to continuous improvement, resulted in a better learning environment for those we serve, our children. The evidence is clear. We are a better school today. I encourage you to thank members of Team ECISD when you see them. Whether teacher, bus driver, counselor, or principal, each and every member of our team deserves to be acknowledged for these accomplishments. We also recognize that we did not accomplish these results alone. Thank you to the ECISD Board of Trustees for their unwavering support and encouragement. Thank you to the hundreds of volunteers who gave their time to read, to mentor, or to support our students and staff. Thank you to the many businesses and organizations who partner with us in this work. Our staff feels your encouragement and thrives because of it. None of this happens without a healthy partnership with our parents and families. Knowing how critical education is to your children's future and the future of our community, you make sure your kids get to school every day on time, finish assignments and homework, and prepare themselves for their future after graduation. Thank you. We also realize that hard work and improvement remain. Our commitment to you is to become a system of excellence. We will be bigger, bolder, and better than we ever have been before. Why? Because our moral imperative as educators is to be our best each day for the children we serve. We will count on you partnering with us. We do this work together.
Osteogenesis treatment. Dear Dr. Roach, a friend gave me a brochure for a company that claims full body light therapy, red and near infrared light. Has multiple physical benefits, including improvement in bone density, among other things. I am a 70-year-old female and lung transplant recipient with a history of osteoporosis. I receive semi-annual Prolia injections. I have never heard of this osteogenesis treatment, and I'm highly skeptical. What is your opinion of this, LK? Answer, I reviewed the data provided by the manufacturer, which showed promising short-term results in rats and mice. I read a doctoral thesis using a cell culture model, suggesting that the mechanism of the light therapy might transmit through the same pathways as the denosumab Prolia injections you are taking. However promising, these are preclinical studies. Many treatments that are promising in animal models fail in humans. Until there is solid data in human studies showing improvement in bone density or, better yet, reduction in fracture risk, I cannot recommend this expensive treatment.
This is the Dear Abby column. Struggling wife at wit's end with unhelpful hubby. Dear Abby, my husband and I have been together for 12 years, and our relationship has started to suffer. We no longer have dates, we don't spend any time talking with each other, unless it's about the kids, and the intimacy has faded. A year ago, I asked him to go to a counselor with me. I asked him to be the one to set it up, as I'm always in charge of doctor appointments, bill paying, etc. I wanted him to show he was all in to help fix our marriage. I have reminded him to do it several times, but he hasn't. He claims to love me and to want our marriage to thrive, yet he does nothing. Now that the intimacy is completely gone, he all of a sudden wants to work on things. Go figure. I feel hurt and rejected, and like throwing in the towel. but we have built a life together, and I do love him. I don't think therapy will work, because I'll feel like I manipulated him to get there by withholding the intimacy. I feel sad and defeated. The man I married is gone, replaced by this person who is just going through the motions and using me to take care of his kids and clean his house. Please advise. Signed, On Hold in Arkansas. Dear On Hold, ask your doctor for a referral to a psychologist and make an appointment for yourself for help rebuilding your sagging self-esteem. Because you long ago assumed the role of organizer-arranger in your marriage, it was unrealistic to expect your husband to suddenly pick up the ball. He may not know how. Once you are stronger emotionally, schedule those sessions with a licensed marriage and family therapist, as you have all the other appointments during your marriage. Your relationship with your husband does need work, and this is the path to repairing it. Dear Abby, my fiancé and I have a child together. I'm 31, and he's 16 years older. Sometimes I don't know if our relationship will work out in the long run, because he's so stubborn and set in his ways. I'm more laid back and easygoing. What is bothering me the most right now is his mother constantly asks him for money. It's not just for little things. It's for roof and furnace repair and problems with her water heater, washer, dryer, stove, and AC. She's married and her husband works. He should be able to provide her with the things they need for their house. It's not like my fiancé is rich. He isn't. I've tried talking to him about it, but it just ends up in an explosive argument. It's like, why should I even try to save our family's future and the things we need for our house if he's going to keep giving it to his mother every time she asks? Please help. Signed, All for Mama. Dear All, you wrote that you are trying to save for your family's future. Is your fiancé giving his mother money that you have been earning, or is it his? If it is his, he can do with it as he pleases, at least until after the wedding. If he is fiscally responsible, he should also be trying to save for the future. However, if he isn't, recognize that the pattern he has established may not be a sound one for you and your child, and plan accordingly. You can write to Dear Abby at dearabby.com or P.O. Box 69440, Los Angeles, California, 90069. Her column is distributed by Universal Press Syndicate.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.